Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm good. I closed out the hour, and I had saved this. Shockingly stupid Mikel Sanchez story. Is this something that I have to imagine either stewards or some group has got to take time with jocks to explain this kind of thing to them. What's your experience when it comes to, you know, the history of this?
I mean, honestly, wouldn't think you'd need to have to explain that. That's a no-no. That's not something you do. I mean, I don't quite understand where his head could have been at. There's really no way to explain that. Now, that being said, I do remember years ago, there was a jump rider. I'm not bringing up his name. He would hedge, meaning, like, so like he usually was riding one of the favorites in the big races at Saratoga. He would figure out who his horse to beat was, and he would bet a 1,000 to win on that horse. So if that horse wound up beating him, you know, he still made a payday. But, I mean, he still rode to win. He was just trying to, you know, figure out how he could, you know, get paid if he couldn't beat a particular horse. Now, I don't agree with it. I think it's 100% wrong. But I know there was a case where a guy used to do that. I mean, I was a kid and I saw it. But, Steve, I can't tell you. The only thing I will say is enough with the excuses and the baloney and the BS. I'm just so tired. Nobody owns it. Like, just own it, man. Like, I'd have more respect if someone just came out and said, it was just stupid. I did it. It won't ever happen again. I'll pay my penalty and move on. But now it's, you know, blame it on something else. It's always something else. It's never, everybody deflects and everybody, you know, comes up with excuses. And that's all it is excuses. You can't do that. And honestly, I think he's lucky he got off with only 2 months.
Well, that's just Pennsylvania. That's just Pennsylvania. Maryland can add to that.
Yeah, no, listen. And, you know, Pete Rose was kicked out of baseball, you know, for betting. Our whole game is predicated on betting and people having confidence. Our credibility is so under attack already, and in some cases, absolutely rightfully so. But, you know, so you add to it, come on, you got to respect this game. We are privileged to do this. I know how blessed I am to do this. I am. One of my dogs thinks I'm upset. I'm not upset. It's okay. I know that I'm privileged to do this, and I know that I'm blessed, and I've been given wonderful opportunities. Well, guess what? With that comes a responsibility to respect the game, treat the game with the reverence and the respect it deserves. And if you can't do that, you don't belong in the game. And I don't care who you are. I honestly wish I could be the sheriff of racing, because Wyatt Earp would be in town. Guys wouldn't like me, but don't disrespect the game that's given me everything in my life. Everything good in my life stems from horses and racing. And if you can't respect the game and understand what a privilege you have, then you don't belong in the game. And that's how I feel.
What kind of, not policing, but policy or advising is given to young riders when they come in? For years, famously in baseball, there's the preseason, rookie, right? That's something that is in baseball lore that, for the longest time, one of the things that you get told at the beginning of, the beginning of training camp of spring training is a advisory about betting, about, you know, not betting. That was the cardinal rule in baseball forever. Who takes that responsibility on and tells a young jock up and coming to be aware and not do it or only bet on yourself to win?
I honestly can't recall. And I'm not saying it didn't happen, but I can't recall anybody ever specifically saying that to me. I don't feel like anybody would have had to, but I mean, apparently, you know, in this day and age, you know, everything has to be, you know, laid out and explained to you. That's a great question. Maybe there needs to be, you know, more education about it. Again, Steve, I honestly never, no one ever had to tell me that. I just thought it was common sense. You know, I don't know. That's a great question. I really don't have an answer. I don't remember anybody ever specifically telling me that. I just kind of always knew it. But maybe, you know, now this is a perfect case in point where this has to be specifically laid out. I mean, you know, again, the whole thing, I'm flabbergasted by it. I can't even imagine. Listen, if you're going to do this too, right, you're going to, you know, I got to say it, be dumb enough to do this, you actually do it in your own name? I mean, I can't make sense of it.
No. No. I mean, it's just crazy.
Listen, I don't know the kid, and you know, obviously, you know, he made a huge mistake, but come on, man, what are we doing here? You know, you're in a position as a rider to make a great living, again, to have an amazing, wonderful life, you know, again, a privilege, not a right. This is a privilege. Take it serious, man. Don't you understand, like, how good you have it? I mean, this has been frustrating me now for a while. You know, I just am so tired of nobody taking responsibility for themselves. Step up to the plate. You know what? People make mistakes. I have more respect for someone that owns a mistake and goes, I screwed up, and I've got to somehow make up for it, and I will, and I'll be better. You know, but legitimately, not just lip service. You know, somebody that steps forward and says, yeah, guess what? I messed up, and I got to fix it, and I got to be better. That I can respect. That I can get my head around. You know, nobody's perfect. I know I'm far from perfect, but not this constant. It's constant wrangling, and it's constant almost justification of bad behavior. Stop it. Just stop. That's all. Please.
Uh-huh. Well, now maybe a little bit more of a nuanced question and response. How many days in a row does it take for a bias to be present for certain riders to know that it's present and take advantage of it, or at least not try to go against it on a repeated basis, because what's going on out there, you know, the last few days was quite something.
If you haven't picked up on this bias by now, I mean, it's as pronounced as it can possibly be. It reminds me a great deal of the Intertrack from years ago. Now, obviously, we don't have the Intertrack anymore, but where, you know, not only was the inside the best part, but it's also the shortest route around there. You know, so not only are you, it's a double-edged sword, you're saving ground, so you're getting the best of it that way. And a lot of times, like what riders, especially young riders, have to figure out is, even if you're held up in traffic and you're saving ground, you're saving horse. And when I rode everything for Michael Hushin years ago, he would rather me get stuck and have to eat one, not have any place to go and eat them and finish fourth, because in his estimation, wasn't a hard race on the horse. But if I put that horse in a four-wide drive for 3/8 of a mile, the horse was worn out. And so not only did you not get anything, or you finished the same probably position fourth, you didn't bring a horse back for him. So, you know, you were always conscious of that fact that, all right, if I stay in here and I don't get lucky, at least it's not going to be as hard a race on my horse. And, you know, the guy who's doing it better than anybody is Trevor McCarthy. And not just because my son works for him. I mean, you watch races. This guy figured it out quick. And even when he's on a closer, okay, this is the hand dealt me. I'm on a closer, a horse that doesn't have natural speed, so I'm not going to get that coveted forward inside position. But I'm going to stay in here, and I'm going to make it work and figure it out. And I mean, it's been a pleasure to watch him ride. I love to watch a guy that thinks and makes a difference. A lot of guys win races on horses that are going to win anyway. It's when a guy starts making a difference and winning on horses that other guys wouldn't have won on. That's what makes a world-class rider, winning on horses that other guys wouldn't have won on. And I'm watching Trevor. I mean, yes, he's riding live horses, but he's also giving every single horse, whether a long shot or a favorite, every opportunity to give it their best. Now, listen, in anything, there are jockeys and there are race riders. Now, a race rider is somebody who's committed to the craft. A jockey, you know, you're light enough, you get your license, you could ride once a month, you're a jockey. If you're a race rider, you have committed to the craft. It's like the difference between bacon and eggs. The chicken's involved, the pig's committed. If you're committed to the craft, you are a race rider. There are guys that go in the room, they don't watch races. They play ping pong, they shoot pool. They don't pay attention. And if you're not paying attention, someone else is, and they're getting the best of it. And there's not a lot that separates the top three or four horses in a race usually. A lot of times it comes down to trips. You know, Andy Sterling is one of the better trip handicappers. He talks about trips all the time. Well, why? Because they're so important. And if you don't put yourself in a position to take advantage of the way a track's playing or the way, mistakes another guy's making, well, someone else is, and they're going to win more races than you. And again, what are you satisfied with? Are you satisfied with being a jockey, or do you want to be a race rider? And that's something when I was teaching the apprentice jockey program at NIRA, I talked about, you know, all the time. You know, yeah, okay, you're a jockey. Are you a race rider? Are you doing the things that the other guy isn't? Are you, you know, kind of mining every tool available to you to be a good rider? Years ago, we didn't have the ability to just go to a replay center and pull up races. You had to go to the stewards and ask for permission to watch a race. And then they would say, okay, come at, you know, 10 o'clock tomorrow morning and we can watch this race. Now you just go to a replay center, pull it up, go to your computer, pull it up. But I see, you know, it's like anything in life. If you're lazy and you don't want to commit to it and put the extra work in, being a jockey is not a job. It's a way of life if you're doing it properly. It's all-consuming. You don't leave it at work. You don't come home and forget about it. It's the way you eat. It's the way you sleep. It's the way you approach the game. It's everything. But there are guys that just, you know, that's too much work for them, I guess. The person nowadays, I would think it wouldn't be too much work.
No, agreed. And I mean, the fact that there's, you know, a TV in the jock's room that is, you know, showing the replay minutes after the race, and you know, you can see pretty clearly. Not to mention that guys are talking about what's going on, and then there's the matter of trainers. That at some point, if there's a trainer saying to you, or a member of the ownership group saying to you, you know, the inside's lightning fast, that it's carrying everybody. I mean, you got to be dead from the neck up, Rich, at a certain point.
Well, you know, and again, I don't want to sound like that. You know, well, back in my day, one of those old curmudgeonly guys. I will say this though. It comes down to desire and hunger and how bad you want it. And, you know, it's not easy to ride that way. And you got to be able to communicate to your owner and trainer. Listen, I know, you know, this horse doesn't always run great inside, but we can't win if we do it that way. So I'm going to try this, you know, like basically laying it out in front that, hey, we've got to play it this way. And if they don't agree, then you know what? They're not paying attention. But it's incumbent upon you as a rider to be able to communicate that to your connections, the things that need to be done to win. You may disagree. You may not. I know when I was riding my best, I kind of disregarded. If I knew what was right, I just went ahead and did it. That's the difference between you're riding good and bad. When you're riding good, you don't take that moment. You don't replace you don't replace instinct with thought. You do it. You know what's right, and you do it, and you don't take that split second to go, if this doesn't work, I'm going to get in trouble. No, you don't care. That's when I talk about riders having swagger. You have to have swagger. You have to be, you know, strong enough in your convictions of things and obviously do the work, be smart about it, that, hey, I know what needs to be done to win. You know, Tom Brady doesn't go to the line of scrimmage and read blitz and go, oh, wait, what are they going to say? No, he does what needs to be done. That's, again, it's how bad do you want it? Do you do the work? Again, anybody could be a jockey. Well, not anybody, but you know what I'm saying. There's a lot of jockeys. There's very few race riders.
One aspect of this that maybe we shouldn't be discounted, I suppose. Any language barrier, wouldn't an agent? Isn't the agent saying to their rider, you know, aren't you aware out there that, you know, the inside's the place to be, or try to stay inside?
You're really giving way too much credit here.
Nobody.
Steve, there's a lot of guys that don't watch races. Good. I mean, you know, it's just a fact. I mean, you know, there's students of the game, people that pay attention to your show, people that pay attention to Talking Horses. You know, there's students of the game, and there's people that just don't really pay that close attention. When I first started riding, Joe Shea was my agent. Joe Shea had been Ron Turcotte's agent his entire career, through secretary and all of that. And he gave me a formula when I was a 10-pound, well, 7-pound bug is when he started for me. I'd won 5 or 6 races. And basically what it was, in sprint races, from about the 3/8 pole, depending on how you're traveling, you start letting yours pick it up, start coming with your run. You know, not all in at once, but that's where you start to pick it up. And longer races, it was more like 3.5-4 furlongs out, because horses are more grinders, let them start picking up. He at least gave me a kind of outline, because when you're a kid, you don't know that stuff. You don't think about it. So here was an agent that obviously was one of the greatest of all time. You know, he was of that era with Lenny Goodman and you know, those guys, that knew that I kind of needed some sort of a clue. How do I, you know, where do I begin with this? But honestly, do you see that, you know, as predominant, where guys are such students of the game? There's exceptions, there's notable exceptions, but I'm not seeing that. And, you know, it's funny to me because, like, I'm very proud of my son because of his work ethic. I think he's working really hard, and obviously Trevor's got an amazing work ethic. He reminds me so much of his father. It's crazy. But where guys think, like, what is hard work? You know, people talk about, like, I do the shows, and I love doing the shows. And you prepare, and it's work, yeah. I'm not digging ditches, man. I'm talking about something I'm passionate about, something I love. You know, so what is hard work? You know, oh, because you got to be at the track early in the morning, that constitutes hard work? No, if anything, I probably paid someone to let me in the backstretch when I was a kid. But I hear guys grouse, oh, it's so hard. Oh, you know, and everybody's doing stuff over the phone now. Everybody's big on the phone. Well, you know, nothing replaces the personal interaction. Nothing replaces being there on the spot, talking to people about races and horses. But the game has changed a great deal like that. And, you know, listen, I talk about agents getting 25%. Now, that's a huge chunk of your earnings. And my son's an agent, I'm saying this. Years ago, they didn't take your money out of the paycheck. You had to bill the owners and trainers for your money. So at the end of a meet, a guy could be into you for $30,000, $40,000, $50,000. And if he says to you, well, you know what, I'm going to give you half, otherwise you're not going to ride everything, what was your recourse? So if an agent could actually get your money, he was worth every bit of that 25%. Once the racetrack started taking the money out for the riders, and, you know, basically just taking it from the horseman's account and putting in the jockey's account, and the end of the week you got your check. Honestly, 25% I always thought was too much. And listen, I'm going to be really unpopular, and agents are going to hate me, and I don't care. This is how I see it. I've seen it that way my whole life. When the Guild was having issues funding our health care, I presented something at the Guild convention that if we cut our agents, you know, 5%, and we can fully fund our health care, and then we can include their families in the health package. So we're taking something away, but, you know, now we're also giving something back. Nobody wanted to hear it. Nobody thought that was a good idea.
Hmm.
And some guys are paying 30%. I mean, you know, you're the one out there. And listen, I can't tell you. There were two or three times I'm racked up after a bad fall getting prepped for surgery, and my agent's on the phone trying to get another rider. I haven't even gotten ring recovery yet. You know, so, you know, people think that maybe I'm being harsh on them, but listen, I've seen the game from both sides, and people say, oh, well, you know, you were always hard on agents, you fired agents. Yeah, I was hard on agents, I was harder on myself, and I never asked an agent to do anything I wouldn't do. You know, I remember, you know, working horses all morning at Belmont, rode the first two races, drove to Delaware Park, rode there, jumped in a plane, flew to Indiana for the Indiana Derby, to Hoosier, got back at 3 in the morning, and worked Crafty Friend at 6 o'clock the next morning. I mean, you know, this is a game of hardworking, honest, hardworking people if it's done properly. And if you're going to make shortcuts or take shortcuts or cheat or whatever it is and not play the game properly, then you don't belong in the game. That's how I feel.
Yeah, and that's very, very reasonable. Nobody, you know, nobody would argue that against. I mean, the commitment. Yeah, it frankly is. It fits the same, you know, storyline and you know, issues that we're seeing. In fact, I can fold in another story. I did get an email, and somebody wanted to get to that in a second. But give me a moment.
You know, Steve, there is rules, right? Like that a jockey can bet on his own horse.
Right.
Through the owner and or trainer of said horse. So if I come to the paddock to ride Lloyd Dobler for you,
yes,
and sound this time, I go, Steve, here's 200. Bet this to win on Lloyd Dobler for me. That's legal. You're allowed to do that. So there's no doubt about your intention. There's no doubt about, you know, you bet on another horse. I can't even imagine that, betting on another horse in a race I'm in. You know, one of my biggest problems, and if it's maybe it wasn't a problem, but one of the things that would almost tear me up is I could ride 100-to-1 shot, and by the time I got to the gate, I had figured out 20 different ways I could win this race. And then inevitably, you know, most of the time they couldn't win. They just weren't good enough. And it would depress me. I'd be torn up about it. It would bring me down, especially big races. You know, ride a horse, but no hoper in the Kentucky Derby. But by the time I got to the gate, man, if this happens and that happens and I can get here, we're going to win this race. So how could, if you have that mindset, could you possibly bet on somebody else? I you know, my whole life I've been betting on me. I left home when I was 14. I bet on me to do this properly. And maybe this is the thing that people got to get in within our industry that don't maybe understand or take it as seriously. Nobody wants to feel like a dupe, like the mark. You know, you don't want to come into a place and feel like you didn't get a fair shake. You know, you don't want to be intimidated. Racetrack, especially for people who are just learning it and coming out, can be an intimidating place anyway. I was walking through the grandstand several years ago at Belmont. It was Father's Day. There's a gentleman dressed nice, wife dressed beautifully, two little girls dressed beautifully, dresses. and he's trying to get a bet in. And it's some crusty old hard-bitten, you know, parimutuel clerk. And he's not calling out the bet properly. And the guy's embarrassing. I'm like, what are you doing? You know. So now the guy walks away. He doesn't get his bet in. He's been embarrassed in front of his wife and daughters. So I walked over. I said, sir, I'm sorry. I couldn't help but, you know, see that you couldn't get your bet in. Let me help you. I took him to a mutual clerk that I know that's an exercise rider for John Kimmel in the mornings that, you know, was working the windows in the afternoon. Hey, Jose, can you help them? Got his bet in. But you have one shot to make a first impression. How are you getting that guy to come back? He already felt intimidated. Now you embarrassed him. Then, you know, if they don't feel like the game is on the level, who wants to play a game they don't feel like can win because they're not getting a fair shake? Credibility is everything in this. And, you know, especially now, there's too much competition for the gambling dollar. You know, even if it's just a recreational thing, a hobby. Well, if I come in here and I don't feel like I'm getting a fair shake at it, it doesn't. Listen, you can go to the races and lose $100. You can have a great time and lose that $100. And if you feel like you got a fair shake, you'll come back. You lost that $100 and don't feel like it was on the level. Well, why would I come back? So that's what we as an industry have to really get through to everybody in the industry. Again, we are privileged to do this. This is not a right. Make sure you take care of the game the way the game takes care of you, because this is how we make our living. And you want to risk driving people away? Come on. We've got to make it fan-friendly, user-friendly. You know, for years, I think people thought, like, jockeys are these little guys, you know, cutting it up in a back room. Well, things like this is a black eye to racing, because that's what it makes people that aren't going to really read into it. And again, 1,000,000% wrong. This is just ridiculous. But immediately, see, it's fixed. It's not on the level. It's fixed. You know, meanwhile, guys are out there busting their ass, working horses, you know, working with horses in this ridiculously cold weather, doing everything they can to make it, you know, the best it can be. And then you get knuckleheads. And that's the only way I could put it, knuckleheads.
That's got a bit of a Tony, that had a bit of a Tony sound to it, and he'll, I'm sure he's got a couple of things that he'll say on Thursday. What I was reaching for as a corollary to this, you've got this situation that Jersey took action against Marvin Richards, as well as against Wayne Potts and his assistant Bonnie Lucas, and that, you know, that door opening is now going to give Naira the opportunity to also review circumstances involving Potts, who is really a poster boy for one of my favorite expressions: when you're walking on eggshells, don't hop.
That's a good one. I never heard that.
There's what you touched on. I mean, with personal responsibility and being a steward of the game and, you know, taking care of the horses first and foremost, and, you know, doing things that are going to represent the sport in a positive light. And I mean, he's like, the guy's like a brush fire. I mean, it's one thing after another.
Again, there are rules. You got to follow the rules. I got jumped on Twitter on Saturday because I bragged about a ride that Trevor gave a horse for him. And first of all, the ruling didn't come out till Friday. The entries were taken, you know, Wednesday. You know, and basically said, how could you, you know, like give praise that he rode a horse for Wayne Potts? Well, first of all, I wasn't even thinking that. But my thought process was, did you see the ride he gave the freaking horse? I mean, it was as good a ride as you're going to see. And I appreciate when guys ride good. I've been so proud of him, of Dylan Davis. There's so many good riders in New York this winter. You know, and then people are like, oh, winter racing. Winter racing, it's hard. First of all, for years, the inner track was the toughest dirt surface to ride in New York, hands down, not even close. And then throw in the elements. It's as hard a thing to do as you're going to do as a race rider as far as being out in the racetrack. But again, you can't, you know, here's a guy obviously hasn't been doing it that long. How do you think you can, this game has been around for hundreds of years. How do you think you can circumvent the rules? I don't even know where you get the audacity to do that. It's disappointing because I've had conversations with the guy and he's personable. He seems like he you know, he's got his head in the right place. And then, you know, everything to the contrary is what you see. So, you know, again, respect the game. If you don't respect the game, you don't belong in the game. That's how I feel.
Well, everybody has, you know, the due process aspects that, you know, that you have to respect and understand. And, you know, it's easy to be judgmental when you don't have any responsibility or any stake in the way in which, you know, the business is conducted. So it's a different, you know, everybody sits in judgment of how, you know, the industry handles anything and everything. If it was all, you know, if it all were, you know, if it was all that simple. It's not.
Well, no, and it's not. And, you know, it's easy to you know, kind of paint these broad brushes. But at the end of the day, it does come down to we have to protect the integrity of the game. And if you're not protecting the integrity of the game, then, you know, think about doing something else. I have too much respect for it. I know what it's provided me. I know what it's given me. All right. I know where I came from, and I know where I've been now. I never flew in a plane in my life until I became a jockey, okay? I've seen the world, literally from the back of a horse. Second flight I ever took in my life, I was in Tokyo to ride the first Japan Cup. You know, I was the kid hiding in the stairwell of the apartment building, reading horse books, dreaming about being a part of that world. So it's offensive to me when people disrespect it.
Nicely said. I referenced an email that I got from our friend Nick, and he asked about the form and our guys looking at the form in the room, and, you know, getting, if it's particularly if it's a horse that they're not familiar with, are they looking at it that way? And I'll mention that, for instance, Gary always asks when the rider comes out. Gary, the first thing Gary will ask after he, you know, after he gives them grief, is, he says, "What do you think here?" And because he wants to hear what the rider has established, you know, what kind of a plan they've got coming out, and you know, if Gary is content with that and agrees that, you know, that's the approach. And I would say the vast majority of times, you know, guys will say, or gals will say, you know, well, there's not a lot of speed in this. He goes, I think I got to be more forward today. And you know, they'll have a plan. I mean, that you know, that's what you're looking for. From that standpoint, are people, you know, looking at the form?
You brought up, like, the replay centers. You know, one of the things that was great about the inner track for years, you know, especially when speed was good, and a lot of it had to do not just with the surface, you know, the kickback was just really, really tough. You know, you'd have, you know, a fleece on, like a turtleneck, a fleece, your silks, and it would, the kickback would actually break the blood vessels in your arms and your shoulders. Like, you'd be done for the end of the day, and you'd just be marked up, right? So horses trying to run through that, that added another dimension of why speed, you know, was more dominant, because a horse that was in behind it was having a hard time running through the kickback. So you'd look at a form. Now, again, it's all these tools. You have all of these tools available. You'd look at the form and go, okay, I have speed, this horse's speed, that horse's speed. Now, if you're really doing your work, you go watch those horses' races. Because a horse that might have speed in the form that by the first calls in front might not have what I consider true gate speed, meaning the first two or three steps aren't the best. Where if the horse I'm on, I know their first two or three steps are really solid, I can take it away from them. So it's not just knowing what looking at a form and going, this is speed. It's knowing who has true gate speed, who's runoff speed, who gets in, who gets out. You have to exploit everything available to you. You have to know everybody's habits. Certain jockeys have habits. Every jockey has habits. A lot of times they're not aware of the habit. But if you're doing your work, you know that, man, if he's in front, the first guy that makes a run on him, he's going to go left-handed and try to float him out, hurt him out. Well, I want to be the guy sitting in behind him. When he floats that guy out, now I'm going to cut the corner and get through. You got to know who the guy who's going to guard the rail with his life. You know, years ago, guys did guard the rail with their life. Nothing was more embarrassing than letting somebody through and beating you. So, you know, you were going to make it as hard as humanly possible on somebody and discourage them for ever even trying to get through on you. So not only do you have to use the form, which is one tool, and I would always have my marks, who I thought was real speed, main speed, who was more of a stalker or secondary speed, who was a true closer. Note, oh, this horse is timid inside. This horse is, you know, will pull up when he hits the front. So if I'm in front and I see the horse that pulls up when he hits the lead coming to me, I don't go all in. I'm going to let him actually get a neck in front of me or a half length in front of me. And when he starts pulling up, then I'm going to go all in because it's hard for him to re-engage once his ears come up and he loses that focus. But if I go all in when he's getting to me and now my horse is running with him, it keeps him interested. See, these are all the things that if you're doing it properly as a rider, you're aware of. And again, being able to articulate it, come to the paddock and not just say, well, I don't see a lot of speed in here. Say, you know, this horse got some speed, but his first two steps are sloppy. I think I can get the drop on him. Know it. Go deeper. Delve deeper, especially with the tools you have.
Yeah, and it becomes, you know, becomes a, I guess, a connections responsibility or obligation. At some point, you know, you if you're dissatisfied with your impression of how this is, you know, how this is going. I mean, that's actually, you know, Rich, that actually is a question that I don't recall even asking Tony over the years that you could riff on. The conversation post race, when trainer and or owner has a certain impression of what went on, and you have to try to explain what might really have gone on, or there's guys also saying things that, you know, that frankly are bullshit, and are going to be seen through right away.
Well, honestly, I was probably almost too honest at times. It helped me in some spots and it hurt me in other spots. And there's things that happen in a race. I'll cite one example. John Kimmel had a filly named Parlay. And she's a real nice filly for the Ackerley brothers. And I rode her in the correction and it looked like a ton of speed. The correction was a listed stake. And John was with the main division in Florida. Loretta Lustig, his assistant, had the winter division in New York. And in the paddock, I had said John had come up for the race. And, you know, there's a lot of speed in here, John. I don't want to be caught like four wide chasing. I was like 7 of 7 or something. And I broke, and I'm trying to ease her back to find a place to tuck. And everybody had the same idea I did. Nobody went. One of those races where it looks like a lot of speed, and everybody's waiting for someone else to take the initiative. And in that eighth of a mile, when I realized, oh, crap, you know, and I was going to gun her, she sulked on me. She got mad that I held her up, and she pinned her ears and just spit the bit out. Now, it didn't look terrible. It wasn't like I was pulling her head off or anything, but she was a finicky kind of filly, and she got beat way off, and I came back, and I said to John, I messed it up. I screwed this up. Nah, maybe she's just not good enough. And anyway, so we go back. He goes back to Florida. Now, I wasn't in with him like I got in with him. And I was working the Philly, and I kept saying to Loretta, you need to run the Philly in the distaff, which is like a grade two. And well, I get on the phone with John, and John's like, the distaff? She couldn't win, you know, this listed race. How's she going to win a grade two? John, I'm telling you, I messed it up. Even though it doesn't look it, I messed it up. Convinced him to run, she won the distaff. You know, paid like $40. And I rode her completely different. I let her bounce along. So being able to be honest when you mess up is just as important as being honest when you don't. You know, if I make a mistake, I was the first one to come back. I did this and I messed it up. And if I didn't do anything wrong, well, why didn't you do this? Well, I didn't have enough horse to get there. I couldn't get to the spot you wanted me to get to. You don't think I wanted to go there? But the greatest line ever. Why didn't you go through that hole? Well, I didn't want to leave the horse. You know, sometimes you just don't have the horse underneath you to get. You see where you want to be. You just can't get there. But, you know, when I was younger, I would say things about horses not in the kindest way. You know, sometimes, you know, you're so intense. You're so competitive. You're starving. You're riding. And I go down this rabbit hole a lot. Like, I'll be doing, you know, work for America's Day at the Races, Steve, and I'll see a horse. And I'll go through the pedigree. And, wow, I rode this horse's Grand Am. And I'll go to Equibase, and I'll pull up that day. Let's say I won on the horse in Saratoga. And I start looking at the whole day. And I can't tell you how many times I rode every race in a day. Now, all right, you know, 5-1, 10-1, 2-1, 15-1. And you ride a long shot for people you ride for. You know, you take the good with the bad. So you might be, well, who is this 27-1? Ah, Richie O'Connell. Ah, he's my man. You know, I'm going to ride anything for him. Wait a second. Who's this horse? 55-1. Who's this trainer? I never heard of this trainer. Oh, this horse came in from Rockingham. I had a lot of agents that would just throw me. Yeah, oh, he's open. Put him on it. With a guy that's living on 750 calories a day, you would think they would have said, you know, give him a race or two off. You don't need to ride this 55-1 shot for a guy I never heard of. I mean, you know, it actually bothers me sometimes. Like, I go, man, didn't guy look out for me? All right, he made $25. He had me out there, and I rode 10 that day, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm seriously. I mean,
like, no, I know. I hear you.
Who's this? First time starter of training Finger Lakes. Wow, it's 60-1. What? You know, like,
hey, well, there's a certain portion of your career where you take that, because you take every ride you can get, and you know, then there's a point where, you know, it changes, and you know, you're not obligated at that. You know, you need to preserve yourself. We, you know, we see this, you know, we see this with some of the great, you know, Hall of Famers that are still riding.
Well, that's how they could last that long. You know, here I was, a guy who's like, you know, or, listen, I got hurt bad young. I mean, I was, you know, 22 when I broke my neck the first time. And, you know, I had some, like, you know, again, jockey breaks the collarbone, and we talked about the movie Jockey, you know, okay, you know, it's a bump in the road, move on. But, you know, you break your neck, your back, spinal injuries, head injuries, you know, brain injuries. You know, there were several injuries where I was out over 6 months, you know, not miss 2 months, 3 months, a cycle or two cycles of your horses. Like, completely obliterate your business. So not only do you have to rebuild yourself mentally to be able to do it, obviously rebuild yourself physically again, get in shape to do it, but you've got to completely start from scratch. You know, yes, you have trainers that are going to help you, but basically you're starting with zero horses to ride. You know, again, an outfit's going to help you. I was always fortunate. I had, you know, going back, Pete Ferriola, Michael Hushin, Kieran McLaughlin, John Kimmel. And, you know, so you knew you were going to get a hand. But essentially, the first day back getting on horses, you have zero horses that you've ridden in 7 months. You're starting from scratch.
And we've had that, you know, between you and Tony, you know, explaining how that, you know, how it comes to pass and how you got to rebuild. And it's a unusual career choice, Rich, to say the least.
Hey, and we'd do it all over again in a heartbeat.
Sure.
We'd never, ever even think about doing something else. But that, again, that's why it gets me mad. That's the only way I could put it. It just gets me mad. You know, I got to ride for 29 years, and I missed, you know, how many, probably almost 3.5 years, you know, 3 years of my career from injury, and then guys take it for granted? Come on, man. You know, this is, again, it's a privilege, it's not a right, and I'm just tired of people not treating it with the respect and the reverence it deserves.
Well, that certainly covers off part of today's, you know, today's topic. You know, there's actually a third. There's even a third story, Rich, that I haven't even gotten to. This very strange situation with Michael Simmons. Did you follow this over the weekend?
I didn't. I did not.
Yeah,
I've been off, Steve, so I haven't been following everything as closely as I normally.
No, that's all right. That's all right. For those that may have, it's funny. Yesterday, when Dave Greinig sent out a tweet, because I had put together selections for the carryover sequence, and he said Dave put out a thing, two late scratches. I think Andy did too. Annika Gold in the sixth and April Antics in the ninth. And that Annika Gold I was going to use, actually, in the sixth. And, you know, I saw that they were both Michael Simmons horses. And, you know, in the back of your mind, you think, well, that's all right. That seems, you know, odd. And then Dave had a story later on in the afternoon that the Gaming Commission is going to investigate a complaint that horses of his were not being fed. He's in barn 61 with, you know, which is a communal barn. There's half a dozen trainers have horses in the barn. And Simmons, you could tell the quotes he gave Dave were angry in response, and completely denies that the horses aren't being cared for properly. So
I don't know any of the story. I don't even know the person. I don't. But you know, we have a fairly stringent protocol as far as horses competing, and they're examined by the state veterinarian. So, I mean, if the horses looked in poor condition, I have a hard time believing that they would have gotten, you know, past the vet. But again, I don't know the details, so I don't want to, you know, talk out of school here. But
I'm bringing it up. This feels like a you know, like a proverbial more to the story story. This is, you know, and from an ownership standpoint, it's the Rocky Guyana Rocky. It's funny. Whenever I see it, I've always assumed that it was Rocky Guyana, but apparently it's Guyana Rocky, and has been campaigning horses a long time in New York.
Right.
We'll see. There'll be follow-up. They're basically waiting for letting the Gaming Commission do what they got to do. But, I mean, every one of these headlines, the headlines go out and the reactions to them go out. And the you know, the follow-up is you know, questionable. It may turn out to be absolutely nothing, but the headline that initially, you know, reaches eyes and ears, it provides a certain impression, and always negative. It's invariably negative. So it just makes it hard for everybody. Puts everybody on the defensive constantly.
Yeah, you know where I stand. I believe me, at this point, I would give my eye teeth for the opportunity to help police this game, because I have too much respect for it to put up with anybody that's not going to treat it with anything less than, you know, the respect it deserves. I can't say it any better than that.
No, that's doesn't need to be expanded on beyond that. It's that says it all. Rich, any particular other than the general observations from the weekend and the way the track has been giving it up to speed, any individual performances that
I gotta be honest, I haven't paid as close of attention that I'm gonna be on Saturday. This is my first day back, so like this week I'll really start paying attention, so I don't want to, you know, say things that I'm going to make myself sound foolish. I just haven't paid close enough attention to
that. Yeah, that's one of those, you know, one of the parts of the game that you can tune away and then you know, tune back. But the one thing that's true is that this bias has got to be, you know, sometimes they, you know, they can play around and try to, you know, try to shift the way the track is playing, and certainly Glenn's as good as there is, and you know, you would think he is doing everything to try to help the track play fair.
I don't think there's a better track man out there than Glenn Kozak. So, you know, usually there's reasonings behind it, weather, this, that. I mean, I don't see anything that would kind of create that right now, but I'm sure it's something that they're thinking about that's on his mind as well. Nobody wants racing that, you know, it's like if you don't have a particular, you know, style, you can't win, right? You know,
we want it to be fair. Exactly. That's exactly the issue.
I mean, as a jockey right now, if I was riding, I would actually love this, because I would be trying to exploit it and, you know, make it the best it could be for me. You know, that's what you do. Essentially, that's what a jockey does, right? Jockeys for position. There's one definition, jockey, to a vagabond, to cheat. There's actually in one of the dictionaries I looked up, that's one of the things for a jockey. I don't think it's flattering.
No, I'll have to look that up. That's pretty funny, Reggie. This was great, and we got a lot covered. We got some of the today's headlines taken care of, and I appreciate, you know, specifically the the heartfelt response to the Sanchez story.
Well, again, I hope the kid gets it straight in his head, and you know, when he gets an opportunity again, if he gets an opportunity again, he owes it not just to himself but to the industry to do it right.
Well, and coming up on Saturday, one of your favorite races, if not your favorite race, the Toboggan on Saturday.
You know what? That race means so much to me. It's crazy. I've told you the story. I'm on the train with my father, and I told him I was going to win the Toboggan as a jockey. And then to win, what did I win, six of them? You know, growing up in Brooklyn, you didn't think Kentucky Derby. You thought Toboggan, Gravesend. Those are the races that I grew up with that you know, someone said the Kentucky Derby. Where do they run that, you know?
And I'm just looking. First one, was Fighting Fit the first one?
Fighting Fit was the first one for Bobby Franco. And now to give you another connection to that, my 7th grade social studies teacher was a guy named Joe Rodlitz, was Bobby Frankel's first cousin.
How about that?
Yep. And he caught me one day. I had the book open, but I had a form folded up in the book in the class, and he caught me. And he told me he had to see me after class, and I thought I was in big trouble. And that's when he told me that who his cousin was. I was like 12, 13, whatever I was. And he said, yeah, my cousin's a trainer, a horse trainer, Bobby Frankel. I was like, Bobby Frankel? Like, I mean, you know, is that, you know? And then we would always talk racing. And as a matter of fact, I mean, it's 12 years ago now, coming on 12 years.
Yeah.
When I retired, the first thing I did, like, that I actually left the house or the property, I went to the opening of Cabin Creek, old friend's Cabin Creek up in Saratoga, and Joe Rodlitz showed up there, and I hadn't seen him in probably 30 years at
that
point.
How about that? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, because, you know, Bobby was so generous with old friends, and, you know, that's why he wanted to be there for that. Yep. So, you know, imagine that, you know, going to school in Brooklyn, and my teacher was Bobby Frankel's first cousin.
That's pretty crazy. And I tell you what, I mean, Fighting Fit had to be one of the first big horses you rode.
Oh, he was a good horse, man.
Oh,
that day,
terrific.
He won. You know, he looked like, you remember the old Jack LaLanne commercials, the guy kicking sand on the smaller guys on the beach, like, you know.
That's Charles Atlas. Charles Atlas.
Charles Atlas. That's what it was. That's what Charles Atlas, right? Well, he comes off the plane from California. He's got that California tan, this horse, right? Huge chestnut horse, all thick all the way through, beautiful. He looked at these other horses like, really? Come on, I'm going to kick sand on you. And he did.
And bringing up that, see, now you're going to bring this really full circle, because Charles Atlas, you know, was Italian and lived in my father's neighborhood in either Bensonhurst or Bay Ridge. And
wow, that's funny.
Anyway, my father says the kids would all go over, and he had weights in the yard, and everybody would watch him work out, and he literally could hold three children on his arms and shoulders. I've got the course, by the way. I sent away at some point when I was 9 or 10 or 11 and got the Charles Atlas course. And you know what it is? It's all isometrics. It's all dynamic tension, and it works. It absolutely works.
That's fantastic. We had a guy on our block, John Zammit. He knew all the wrestlers, and he was a real old man. He used to tell me he was a jockey, and I could never find his name in any of the books, John Zammit. But we're talking about he was, you know, maybe 80 years old in the 70s, you know. And he was talking about when he rode, and then he would have all these pictures with all the wrestlers of that era. And I remember him having Bruno Sammartino, Chief J. Strongbow, and there was one other that he had them all come to our block, and all of us kids were going nuts. Especially for me, Bruno Sammartino was my favorite, right? Mr. Zammit brought all these great wrestlers, and I remember Bruno Sammartino bought us all ice cream. The ice cream good humor guy was coming through the neighborhood, and he stopped them and he said, give the kids whatever they want, it's on me. He was phenomenal. That's fantastic.
That is great. And I just looked it up. Angelo Siciliano.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He was born in Acre in Cosenza, came and ended up, he died in Long Beach in 1972. Wow. I didn't even realize but my dad, I remember my dad telling me Charles Atlas in the neighborhood. That's funny.
Cool. That's really cool.
I love it. Well, this was unbelievable, as always. And Richie, have a great week.
Never know what direction we're going to go.
No, that's the beauty. That's the beauty of it. Well, I appreciate the freewheeling too, because we weren't sure we were going to have a show today. We had internet issues down in Florida, and so I was sort of tentative, sending out requests for people. So I only had you and Ben Goldberg lined up, and I didn't send out any other requests. So time well spent.
Steve, look forward to seeing you.
See you soon. Rich Migliori, everybody. Mig4450 on your Twitter. Let's take a break. Hour three coming up. And as mentioned, Ben Goldberg's going to join us and spend a segment with him. Back after this.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Here in Pennsylvania.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced